now to our next presentation, which is from James Stevens, and he is an associate professor at the Department of Biosciences at Exeter University. And James is going to talk to us about conserving genetic diversity in Atlantic salmon, the challenges of chalk stream populations in southern England.
Hi, thanks very much for the chance to speak this morning. It's very nice to come along and talk to an audience of very diverse people. When I started out in talking to audiences about salmon about 20 plus years ago with a good friend of mine, Dr. Dylan Bright, it was pretty obvious that whilst not everyone was knowledgeable about genetics, they knew a lot about salmon. So never underestimate your audience. That's one thing I've learned. It's nice to be in a session that has a very broad focus. So I see we've got the plight, the poetry and the science. I'm definitely in the science camp. I will veer into the plight because what we do helps kind of illustrate the plight. I'm going to stay away from the poetry because, as my wife will tell you with her head in her hands, I really only recognise poetry if it rhymes. And none of my talk rhymes. Just to thank everyone, Mark and the team, and Janine and John for inviting me as well, because it's, as I say, it's a really nice honour to be here. So what I'm going to talk about is chalk stream salmon, a small, relatively numerically small group of salmon that inhabit rivers in the chalk streams of the south of England. But for this audience, I think, and from the talk we just heard from Will, it's important to realise that the chalk stream salmon, the things that I'm going to talk about with them are applicable to pretty much any of the different genetic and diverse groups of salmon that we might care to look at and might care to think about preserving. So what I've got here is two different salmon habitats. Okay, the one on the right might be one that you might recognise as a more traditional kind of salmon habitat. Although this picture is actually taken in Spain, not the kind of thing that might immediately spring to mind as a salmon, a place for Atlantic salmon to thrive in. But these rivers run off the mountain range called the Picos de Europa, and you can go up there and build a snowman even in late spring, and look at the pools where a lot of the young salmon will be starting out. On the left here is a shot of the River Frome in Dorset. This is a lovely meandering water meadow, and this is a highly productive salmon river, but extremely different in its topography, its flow rate, its chemistry than that perhaps more traditional salmon river on the right. So this is where I attempt to really get big on tech. This, I think, is a really nice little sum up. This is a World Service broadcast about the question about will my salmon swim home, and I see some pros and some cons in this broadcast, and I'm going to take you to about a minute in, and you'll hear two gentlemen talking to the BBC reporter about what they hope to do in terms of potentially helping to restore salmon on a tributary of the Thames. Okay, so the Thames, possibly the biggest chalk stream in the world. That's 25th of October 2019, and I think it's great that we're looking at thinking about how we might do this to the river and kickstart that river. But the podcast ends with this thing where the guy from the Environment Agency is asked, can we do this? And he says, yes, and you know, I know how a friend of mine is an editor, and I know that you can edit stuff pretty. All right. What I want to talk to you about is we've almost already answered this question with some of the people at the Environment Agency, and the answer is kind of yes, but mostly no. Just chucking those eggs in isn't going to do much good, and it all comes down to understanding the diversity and potentially local adaptation of any particular group of fish that you choose to put in an environment. And that is absolutely, absolutely key. and it almost, I started to write a slightly ranty letter to the lady who did this, but then I gave up because it's all about, you know, it's good that they're getting the message out, but the simplicity of it is just, it just appalls me sometimes. anyway, can I just do my thing? So I'm sorry, it's so useless. I'm the map user usually. Yeah, that's right. And then on to that. Brilliant. Okay. So that's that, and we'll just touch on that at the end if I have time, if I'm not being red flagged too heavily. What I wanted to just, there are not that many talks on the sort of background science. So this is a phylogenetic tree, and the group we're interested in are here. That Salmo, what's that? It's not showing on that one, is it? Here we go. Here's Salmo salar, split from the rest about 12 million years ago. There was a whole bunch of things happening around that time. I'm not going to go into that here. But you can see there's a lot more trout species recognised than there are salmon. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think when we look, it may be the case, but I think at least when we look into the salmon, if we look deeply enough, we will recognise evolutionary significant units that may well constitute different species. And that's one of the things I think is important, going back to the previous talk. We can only really conserve things if we know the units of what we're conserving. If we lump everything together, it ain't going to work, because we may well say, oh yes, we've conserved it, but if you've got bits of it that are being missed out of that conservation overview, then you're destined to lose maybe quite significant parts of the overall diversity of your target species. So that's where we are, and we're talking about this one species, and I'll show you it may well not just be that case, in amongst all these other Pacific salmonids and salmo species, and then the rest of the salmonid. So where are they? Where is Salmo salar? Salmo salar is on the northeast of the US continent, North American continent, and in Western Europe. And even there, we can kind of have our first glimpse of the fact that these are maybe not even the same species. In the west there, on the east side of North America, they will have 27 chromosomes, while in Europe they'll have 29. So straight away, a big difference. And that's why it's so easy, even in the early days of using genetics, to understand and apportion catches between stakeholder countries, that within the West Greenland fishery, it was possible to recognise those fish of European origin and those fish of North American origin based on just a few allosomes. So this is going back to the 1980s. And it's not surprising when you've got chromosomal differences between your species. However, if we want to dig a bit deeper into the intra-specific variation, we need to look at some studies that have kind of tackled this question of looking at variation across that range overall. Now, getting the money to do that has never been easy. We've managed to do some of that through a European-funded project, which was the brainchild of Dylan and Ireland going way back. So this is the Atlantic Southern Arc Project. And I think Ken may also have had a helping hand in that one. Ken certainly had a helping hand in this one, and that's the SOLSI project. And I think Ken will talk a bit about that in his talk. Where's Ken? He's here somewhere, isn't he? So I suspect SOLSI will get a proper work through. Yeah, brilliant. but these projects were not aimed at understanding primarily the phylogeography and the diversity of the species. What they were aimed at was creating tools to allow us to track fish that were moving in the marine environment and to be able to assign them back to a population of origin so that they could be used to help see where fish were going in the marine environment, because that still remains one of the big black boxes of the continuing decline in our chosen species. So we've kind of, the results I'm showing you have come out of work that was essentially targeted at something slightly different. So this is the Atlantic Salmon Art Project, and we were able to type juvenile fish sampled in these rivers, the red and blue dots, throughout the western seaboard there of the southernish part of Europe. And what did we find? This is what we found. So I apologise, it's slightly low down on the screen, but I would say be think to your rugby team colours, but I know that there's not a great deal of rugby played in Spain, so think of your football team colours. And what you have is you have your Spanish fish here, your French fish here, your Southwest English fish here, your Welsh fish, your Irish fish, and your Scottish and Northern English fish. And what you see, this is a map, this is a presentation of the genetic diversity of the populations that are all characterised genetically here. Okay, this is how we ordinate them in space, to look at how these genetic profiles are more or less associated with each other. And what we see is that there is a strong relationship between your genetic differentiation and your geographical differentiation. So you move from your Spanish, that are more or less closely related to your French, which are more or less closely related to your Southwest England, to your Wales, Ireland, etc. The one group that doesn't fit within that trend, which we would call in a population genetic sense is isolation by distance, the one group that doesn't fit is that group, and those are the chalkstream salmon of southern England. They really do not fit the picture. So there's something different that is stopping them exchanging their genetics, their alleles, with their neighbours. Right? There's something. It obviously isn't just distance. Right? There's something more. And I suspect it's coming down to the geology and the characteristics of the water in those streams. Moving on from that, a slightly bigger study. This is the Solsea study. These are all the populations that were analysed using this particular genetic marker, these microsats, in the Solsea project. So this is led by John Gilby and Eric Verspore and Phil McGinnity and people like that. And I was a small part of this. And this basically extends that study I showed you a minute ago to include all of Russia, Norway, Scandinavia, Iceland. And this is, to me, this is the most amazing thing to come out of it. Again, this project was aimed primarily at understanding how fish move at sea so that we can begin to make an assessment of marine mortality. But the key thing here is these two little circles, I can show you. So what we see is that all of the fish in that map that I just showed you, bar this group here, all of these fish essentially share common ancestry, share a genetic similarity. And they're all different, and you can see, again, that kind of Klein thing. So you go from the Kola Peninsula, the Tino up in Finland, Finnmark, Norway, and then you're moving down through the continent. Apart from this group of oddities here, the Baltic fish, okay, with their own immunity to Gyrodactylus and Icelandic fish, and these northern Spanish fish, and out on its own completely, the English chalk fish. Okay, so if ever there's a candidate for looking at fish which don't fit in and can't be generalised with the rest of the salmon in Europe, I would make the case that it's the English chalkstream fish. Looking at this with slightly a different genetic marker that has slightly better coverage, remember I told you there were 29 chromosomes in the European family, we had only 12 loci in those studies, so only 12 points across the genome, so that's one, not even one per chromosome. Moving to something called SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, which give us a genome-wide scan. We've got thousands of SNPs in here. You can see that big split between North America and Europe. This is work by Sigbjorn Lien in Oslo at SciGene there, and a whole bunch of other authors. And then looking again at the next axis of separation between these genetic profiles, you can see your Atlantic, your Russian, and your Baltic. We still don't know where our chalkstream fish fit in because they didn't include any in this study, and that's something that me and my group are quite keen to do. And if we look a little more detail about what they did include, they chose some Spanish fish, one fish from the Loire and some Icelandic fish. So not even, in my particular view, a particularly good representative fish group. But hey. So they were choosing all these guys. So I think we can do better than that, and that's what my group is working on at the moment. Just to dive, to take you to chalk for a moment, this is chalk, all right? This is Burton Bradstock Beach. It's a big lump of it, actually. This is Burton Bradstock Beach, down there in Dorset, just by West Bay. Lovely part of the world. Very nice restaurant there called The Hive. A bit expensive, but you need to get in. Very nice. Chalk is here, and the rivers I'm going to talk have been talking about and will talk about in the remainder of my time, if I have much left, are around here. But the chalk band extends all the way up there, and you can see the Thames is the biggest chalk stream of all. These are the chalk streams of England, as categorised by the Environment Agency, if you're interested. So they have particular flow qualities. They're low in energy, very low on spate, high on nutrients. They have fantastic water quality, typically slightly alkaline, beautifully clear, high nutrient load. And that's what makes them so special. And this is what we've done most recently. This is to start to look at the division between the chalk and others. And we've expanded our original study to include our Norwegian fish. So for the first time, we can see how different the chalk are from the Norwegians. Those Norwegian fish signatures, by the way, are also useful in understanding escapes from fish farms. I won't go into that now, I don't have time, but that's another tool that we can use. We can do even better than that with our first foray into using these genome-wide scanning approaches. This is a SNP study. This mirrors that one that I showed you by the Norwegian group a minute ago. On the left, we have fish populations from southwest England, and on the right, we have our chalk streams. Extremely condensed genetic variability compared to even those fish within the southwest of England. And you can imagine when we add in our Norwegian representatives to our sample base, the scale of diversity in those in the broader thing will expand. But this is key. They're so distinct, these chalk stream fish, and that's why, you know, I'm really looking forward to making a case for them. Just to come back to that final thing in my final 1.5 minutes, here's some data from the Environment Agency. These are salmon put into the River Thames, okay? So this is a well-meaning initiative costing hundreds of thousands of pounds of our money, all right? So from the 70s to the mid-80s, they were putting tens of thousands of salmon at different life stages into the Thames. Great, all right? They were actually putting in Irish fish and seconds of Scottish hatchery fish. All right. So from what we know so far, you might expect them not to do very well. And what you see is that the salmon in the Thames that were caught trail off immediately that the stocking effort stops. So essentially what the Environment Agency did with our money was to create the world's biggest put-and-take fishery. All right. But in the late 2000s, we were contacted by guys from the Environment Agency because they'd started to find that catching some salmon around Molesey Weir, they found they were getting both tagged fish, which were the ones that they knew they'd released, and they were getting untagged fish. So where are the untagged fish coming from? What is, you know, where are these wild ones? Is it that there's been a... that the fish that they put in have actually established a breeding population or not. So what we did, as you can probably guess, is we did some genetic analysis using our database to see where those untagged, newly arrived fish coming into the Thames had come from. And lo and behold, what it looks like is that they, when we did our assignment analysis with our genetics, highest probability back to these rivers here. In fact, they assign not just with highest, but the extremely high probability to these rivers here. And what it looks like, almost certainly, is that fish from here have strayed, and we know that it's about an 8 to 11% inbuilt straying capacity within the within all salmon is, otherwise they wouldn't have recolonized all these rivers after the last glacial maximum. We would just have barren rivers, all right? And so almost certainly, because the Thames has got cleaner, because a lot of the barriers have been removed, fish are now starting to naturally refine this fantastic habitat. What the long-term future is, we don't know, I don't know. But to answer that, go back to that question, I'm not going to put the thing back on again, but will my salmon swim home? Well, the answer is, it might, if the water's clean, if the waterway is open, and that the fish that you've used to initiate that program are locally adapted and locally suited to that particular environment. And just to finish, I'd like to thank a couple of people who were instrumental in helping me get involved in that this work, which is Dr. Dylan Bright, who was took over from Ireland at West Country Rivers Trust, a great friend of mine, and much missed. And then other people from the Spanish team with whom we worked on the EU project, the members of my lab, the various EA fisheries teams who, despite the negativity I may have exuded this morning, have always been on the ground really involved and interested in this work, and the various funders. So thank you very much.